From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. As a Bosnian refugee in Sweden, Adnan Mahmudovic worked as a caregiver for people with brain damage. He used that experience to influence his writing.
You have to allow yourself to be both professional and intimate at the same time. And I think that's the core of writing.
We'll talk about Mahmudovic's life and the use of humor in stories about refugees. But first, Rebecca Cruz and I will discuss this week's decision by the Trump administration to forego its planned appointment of an ambassador to South Korea, and the first use of Israel's anti-boycott law after the singer Lorde canceled her concert there.
It's also a big question about who can be charged with an Israeli law, considering that these are not Israeli citizens.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, it's good to see you back here in the studio. I've just returned from Rio. So let's talk about a couple of really interesting issues going on this week. We know the Olympics are coming up. The Winter Olympics are coming up in South Korea. South Korea is in the news this week. But from the U.S. side, this week, the Trump administration decided to no longer appoint Victor Cha, who'd been slated to be the next U.S. ambassador to South Korea, decided to pull that appointment and forego, at least for now, an ambassador to South Korea, U.S. ambassador to South Korea. Now, Victor Cha is an academic. He served under George W. Bush. Everybody was very excited about this, including the South Koreans. They were really excited about him coming. But there's a dispute about his lack of support for the Trump administration's policy toward North Korea, about keeping on the table a limited strike, military strike, and about trade policy. So tell us a little bit more about what's going on here.
Yeah, the hope was that he would get through all the processes and would be there in the next 2 weeks to join in the Olympic ceremonies, but that's not going to happen. So that means that this very important post stays empty for the time being. And I think that that's the real concern here, that obviously the situation with North Korea has heightened and South Korea plays a crucial role there. So to not have a permanent representative in the State Department for us is a concern. But you could say on the other side of things that because it is so crucial and the administration has been so involved that they do have a presence there. So you could look at both sides of that. But yeah, the issue comes down to his apparent comments off the record about criticisms towards the Trump administration about a policy that is seen as incredibly hawkish, which is somewhat surprising because he is actually viewed as somewhat hawkish himself. He has not been very dovish on the situation. Military options have been in his repertoire here, but he did voice this concern and it got back to the Trump administration and they have essentially taken back what was expected to be a nomination and an easy approval.
And then, of course, there's a trade agreement. I mean, South Korea is one of our strongest allies. And so it raises questions here, too, about, I mean, our ally really wanted this guy who's a major expert and a Republican and has worked for Republican administrations before. So anyway, it raises all kinds of interesting issues for our diplomatic corps.
Absolutely.
Under this administration. Well, let's move on to another part of the world, to a pop culture issue, Rebecca. The singer Lorde withdrew from giving a concert in Israel. And this week there was a lawsuit against the activists that encouraged her to do so. And it's the first time that there has been the use of Israel's new law, anti-boycott law, which is quite controversial in Israel even. But the whole point is that they'll sue for damages for those who boycott Israel in the case of this singer. They're not suing the singer. They're suing those who encouraged her to actually drop out. How do we interpret this situation?
Yeah, it's very fascinating. This was a law that was passed in 2011, and as you said, was very controversial, but it went through the Supreme Court in 2015, and they were fine with it. But this is the first time it's being used. It's three teenagers who bought tickets to the concert and now are claiming that they need some sort of reimbursements and hardship fees. So it's about $13,000 that they're asking for. So this is going to measure a lot of things. So the viability of this law, who can use it, how it will be managed. It's also a big question about who can be charged with an Israeli law, considering that these are not Israeli citizens. So what is the jurisdiction there? And that's going to raise all sorts of interesting questions there. This really comes after a movement, a global movement that's been going on for about the last decade or so. It's known as the BDS movement. This is Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. And this is initially a Palestinian grouping of NGOs and other interested entities that have sought to bring attention to the Palestinian situation in Israel. They've grown and kind of modeled themselves on the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa in the 1970s and 1980s. And this has gained in momentum as more and more activists are calling for boycotts, calling for divestment, and obviously sanctions. So this was really targeted towards them. And we'll see what the result is here and what this could mean for future boycotts and future activist activities. But it raises a lot of questions.
It definitely raises questions. It'll be interesting to watch because this is an interesting case, as you mentioned, the teenagers, but also just the effectiveness of such a law and the ability to push back and resist things that you're, you know, concerned about, activists engaging in boycotts and things like that. So lots of interesting questions that will play out here and we'll be paying attention.
Well, and it should be noted that Israel is not the only country that has these boycott laws. There are some in the United States as well as in France, so they are not alone.
That's true. All right. Well, thank you so much, Rebecca, for being here today.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at WorldviewsKGOU and I'm at Suzette Gorlat. Next, we'll talk with writer Adnan Mahmoudovich about writing, humor, and refugees. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Adnan Mahmoudovich fled Bosnia in 1993 and became a refugee in Sweden. There, he worked with people with brain damage while he studied and eventually earned a PhD. His writing often centers on the stories of refugees and have a healthy dose of humor. Mahmoudovich is now a lecturer and writer-in-residence in the English department at the University of Stockholm. I spoke with him while he was in Norman for the Neustadt Festival of International Literature and Culture. Adnan Mahmoudovich, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you here. Adnan, let's talk a little bit about your background. You're a novelist and a literary scholar, but you were born in Bosnia,
yes.
Left Bosnia as a war refugee in 1993 and moved to Sweden. So then you spent most of your life growing up there. So tell us a little bit about that background of yours. And in particular, it's been noted that you worked for about 10 years with people that had brain damage,
yes.
All before you then decided to study English and become a writer and a literary scholar. So kind of how did that happen? You from Bosnia,
yes.
To working with people with brain damage in Sweden to being a writer and a literary scholar.
Well, I was 17, 18 when I came from Bosnia as a refugee. And I was growing up in which was then former Yugoslavia, that time of brotherhood and love and all that, which then turned out to be something else. So when I came to Sweden, we were in all these, we were moving from a refugee camp to a refugee camp, so we were kind of moving around quite a lot. And at some point, Sweden decided that they would just keep all of us. So we got green cards, everyone, the lot. And so in that first period, I was in a really small town in southern Sweden. There's just a couple of buildings and woods, endless woods and moose and all kinds of animals. It's just really, really beautiful, but very depressing as well. And I was sent, like all of us, just so we were, you know, studying Swedish as everyone did. And then we had to work at different places from time to time. So we would spend maybe 3 months painting a school, or and then 3 months in on a farm, or 3 months washing dishes in a hotel, or you know, different places. So that's how we sort of got introduced into the Swedish society. I wanted to study art, and I got a job on the side working with a blind person, like a care assistant. And I kind of liked that. And at the same time, I was studying English on my own, because I realized that my German was kind of useless. And I was just listening to all those tapes and just studying English on my own. And then I moved to Stockholm, looked for work, and wanted to continue studying. And I found this job, which was really a chance. I don't know. It was a faith, I would say. I started working as a care assistant for a guy in a wheelchair. He'd had stroke, and that became like my introduction into the Swedish life, and a huge part of who I am now was built through those 11 years that I worked with him and other people with brain damage. But I was studying at the same time, so it wasn't really like I did that work and then studied. Rather, I would work at night, so I worked night shifts, and then I studied daytime, building a family, and I didn't want to take loans and so on. I got really interested into languages, because when I was back in Bosnia, I didn't believe that a person could speak another language. That's why I never learned any German, which I had in school like for 5 or 6 years. So I never could really speak German or use it. I was completely useless at German. And learning Swedish, I thought it was great fun. I was like, oh, wow, I can actually do this. And then I moved from someone who had studied engineering to someone who just loved languages. And this person I worked with, he loved literature. He worked as a journalist for many years. So that's how I sort of got into languages as well, and literature, and got into English literature. I was inspired by some really amazing teachers, yeah, the rest is history. So I basically just worked and studied at the same time.
Goodness, what a path you've had. There's so much that I want to follow up on. But just one thing in particular, you said that working for the stroke patient and other brain damaged patients, that you then developed into the person that you are through that work. You made a specific reference to that work developing you into who you are today. What do you mean by that? How so?
I mean that you have to connect. You have to allow yourself to be both professional and intimate at the same time. And I think that's the core of writing, that you have this you have the craft, you have the skills, you have the professionalism, but at the core of it is kind of intimacy that is essential. Getting closer to someone, and at the same time keeping some distance. So I think that balance between distance and intimacy is essential for writing. That you have to be able to see the bigger picture, but also to remain in that place of intimacy, which is kind of dangerous. I feel it's risky, but it's important, because what you do as a writer is exactly what I did as a care assistant, and that is to care and to actually connect with another human being who is completely different from you. In every way, from age to religion to nationality to whatever. And that is something that I experienced publishing my first story, which was actually here in the States, when one of the editors wrote back to me, and she had loved my story so much, and I couldn't believe that someone, across the pond could connect to something I was writing. you know, this Bosnian story is very kind of small-time story about these Bosnian women. And where did that come from? I just couldn't figure it out. And that, for me, is the kind of miracle of writing, that connection, that care, that intimacy, which I think is the essential for writing as such, for life, for everything, yeah.
That is absolutely incredible how you've articulated that connection. And I mean, obviously, connection is what I think, why we read.
Yes.
We read,
yes.
we enjoy literature, you know, in all of its forms, and other art forms as well, as a way to connect. But that way in which you characterized being kind of at the same time distant and close or intimate, and how that is kind of dangerous and risky. How it's a fine line to walk, I guess. But you also are funny. You also use a lot of humor. And so I'm gonna transition to that, because I think it's related too, in that it can be risky to use humor. But as an example, on your website, you say the quote across the top of your website: funny stories about sad refugees and sad stories about funny refugees. And then you also, in some of your writings, and just even like titles, the way in which you play with words, how to fare well and stay fair.
Yes.
It's like you've got this way with words it's comical. It's funny. I mean, if you look at what you do, you've worked in the comic world.
Yes.
Your works include a title, Visions of the Future in Comics. So some might think that's completely different. And we've had a conversation now for 9 minutes and you haven't told a joke. But that's not really what we're talking about here, because humor is also, isn't it, that very precarious place where you get close enough to something to be humorous about it, but it also requires some sort of distance. Somebody who does research on humor called it benign violation.
I like that.
Right? That it has to be a violation of something that makes it funny, but it has to not hurt.
Yes.
And so you get close enough, but not too close. You don't go over that line, right? So does that make sense? And so is that related to this whole thing here? And can you tell us a joke now?
No, I'm just kidding. That's
tough. So where does humor come into all of this? Because clearly, when I look at your stuff, you're a very funny guy.
Yeah.
So how does humor play?
Well, actually,
I
discovered that. I didn't know I was funny. What happened was that I thought I was writing these really serious, dark stories about refugees, and then I was reading them aloud at different events, and then people would laugh, and it's like, what's going on here? Why are you laughing? These are sad stories. And, but yeah, definitely, because humor is a part of that. And I think it's needed partly, I think, as a way of dealing with trauma.
It's a way to deal with discomfort, right?
We laugh
because otherwise we'll cry.
We laugh because
we don't know what else we'll do.
Yes, because it's just, and I realized that in order for me to respect these traumas, these really sad stories of these refugees, is to actually respect the way the people are, for real. One thing I didn't like about some post-war writing was that it was trying to be too nationalist, it was trying to be too patriotic, it was trying to be things that or describe people the way they were not. And for me, that was funny. You know, it is. People are funny. So I would listen to these stories, and someone might object, like, "Oh, how can you characterize this, you know, old Bosnian woman who is who you know wears a headscarf, for instance?" And you think that's really serious. And then you tell something about her that, you know, how she, for instance, used a remote control to, you know, hit her husband on his thing, you know, and that, for me, that characterizes that person to the core. I mean, that for me brings me really close to her. Now, she may be a lot of things, and that is one of those things. And someone might admit that. I don't, because that is reality. And that's what I found about all these, all of us refugees. We're also, I think, you don't want to laugh at refugees, and I think that's obviously you shouldn't, in a sense. But we are silly as well as people. And the way we deal with nostalgia, for instance, we are ridiculous, all of us. I realized that when I was in all those refugee camps. I mean, things people did, like smelling dirt and thinking, you know, that's the smell of my old country or something like that. It's,
I think what you're, maybe getting at is, I mean, you use the word kind of realistic or real, but it's kind of human, right? Mm-hmm. Is that, I mean, it's exceptionally human to be nostalgic, to no matter whether you're a refugee or not, to, you know, maybe the funny part is in kind of how we're nostalgic, but that we're all these things. And so it kind of, again, maybe develops that connection between people, regardless of who they are and what their experiences are, is that this is all just really about being very, very human.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it is essential that we can laugh at ourselves. Because we...
Because otherwise we'll cry.
We will cry. We have to laugh at ourselves in order to remain humble as well. I think if we are not open to be laughed at and to make fun of ourselves, then... I think we are entering into some kind of dangerous zone of of being,
The humility side of it too, That, but I mean, not everything is funny. You talk about sad stories about funny refugees, but funny stories about sad refugees. I mean, is that not everything about refugees is funny?
No.
not every story about refugees is sad either, right? I mean, does that make sense going both ways?
That's why I actually put it that way, is because it is both ways. It's like just a circle. Like you have those things, the sadness and the fun, and then
Sadness and then fun, and sometimes fun out of the sadness, and sometimes sadness out of the fun. Well, Adnan, that's such a great way to describe it, and your life experience is really incredible, and really appreciate you being here today to share it with us and to share your work. And I look forward to reading more of it and laughing.
Yes, thank you so much. A pleasure being here.
You've been listening to my conversation with writer Adnan Mahmudovic. He is a lecturer and writer in residence at the University of Stockholm. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Grolot.